Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew. Tonight, my guest is Pierre Sabak. Before I bring him on, I have to thank My Patriot Supply. They are, of course, the experts in emergency preparedness. And right now, with all the uncertainty and turmoil in our country and around the world, it definitely would not hurt to have an emergency food supply on hand. Right now, you can get $70 off a two-week and $100 off a four-week food supply of their delicious food, and it lasts 25 years in storage. Just go to preparewithfkn.com or just click the link in the description to get your food supply today. Today, I want to welcome Pierre Sabak. He is an expert on ancient symbolism and etymology. He is widely recognized as a leading academic in the fields of religion, mythology, mysticism, and the esoteric. New ufology is the study of occult symbolism to deconstruct the ufological tradition, a restricted teaching equated with the flying saucer and its occupants. As a completely new field of research, the focus of new ufology is scaphology, the study of angelic boats within religion and mythology. His work on the saucer cults details a secret alien code within language, one that is identified archaically with the angelic sailor and its human and non-human hosts. Pierre, welcome. How are you doing tonight?
Hi, it's great to be on your show. Thank you very much, Chris, for inviting me.
Well, Pierre, I'm looking forward to it. When you go back and look at ancient texts and scriptures, hieroglyphics, petroglyphs, and even more modern artwork, the evidence becomes very compelling that the ancients were depicting very similar objects that we now call UFOs or UAP. And more independent researchers like yourself are examining and presenting this information. And the more evidence that we have, the more we can understand and get what these things in the sky these ancients were describing, as well as their interactions with the beings from the craft or other entities. What I want to start with tonight is, what got you started looking into this symbolism and connections to ufology?
Well, my interest really started as a child. When I was a child, I saw what looked like ostensibly a rocket within a field, and it took off at a right angle and it flew over my head. And from that point onwards, I was very much interested in the paranormal and flying saucers. So that was, if you like, my initial interest. But then when I became older, I mean, my expertise originally was fine art, and so I studied semiotics at university, which is the deconstruction of the sign, which really feeds into symbolism, which I refer to as the Illuminatics, which is the study of the codes of the Illuminati. So I came from this fine art background, and I really started to study authors like Professor Temple, who was talking about the Sirius mystery and the Dogon, and the Dogon tribe, and the Nomu, which was these fish deities, and this correspondence with Sirius. And so that's where I really began. But in order to go into this information, I really needed to study occult symbolism. And the way into occult symbolism is through language, which is through etymology. Now, the Greek word etymology comes from the root etymos, which means truth. And so therefore, you're seeing that there is within language this code which refers to the others. Now, this code is referred to in Greek as allosagoria, other speaking. Now, this other speaking is referring to allos, other or another. And again, allos can be represented with a halo, which is halos. So if you want to represent the others, which is this angelic tradition, you would represent them with halos, which is an halo, which refers to allos, the others, or another. And this is appertains to this private discourse, allegory or allosagoria. Now, within the Greek, this type of private discourse is also known as ideoglossolalia, which is a private discourse. So it's a very specialized field, and it's a field which has not really been delved into that much because it's this classified tradition. And I really want to try and highlight what I mean by this classified tradition, because in the ancient world, particularly within the classical world, you see that the classics was based upon the naval tradition, which is classis, a naval fleet. Now, classis is referring really to the angelic tradition, because in the Hebrew and the Semitic, the word malak, an angel, is polymorphic of malak, which is a sailor. So the angelic tradition is really a representation of the naval tradition, and the naval tradition goes into classics, which is classic, which is the classical tradition. Now, the classical tradition is classified, and this is a restricted or a secret teaching. So that's really, if you like, new ufology, because new ufology describes occult symbolism relative to the deconstruction of the angelic vessel. Now, I refer to this as scaphology. Scaphology is coming from the Greek root scaph, which is a light vessel, but again, it's coming from the etymology of scapto, which is to dig out or to hollow out, because a light vessel is hollowed out. And so scaphology is really studying this connection with these hollow vessels, which were depicted as circular. And this is another point which is really, really important, because I think many academics within the field, they tend to presume that ufology is this modern field which has just occurred within the 20th century. But really, it goes back to this angelic tradition, and it goes back to these angelic sailors, which were depicted in conjunction with these angelic vessels, boats or ships. And that's something which I really want to try and talk about tonight as we go into the subject. So,
yeah, definitely. I love the term new ufology, because to me, it's kind of like marrying the nuts and bolts side to the metaphysical or spiritual side of ufology, which I think is the major thing missing in this field right now, is the understanding of the more ancient, the ancient texts, and how it could be more of a spiritual type of thing happening out there. So new ufology, I really like that term.
Yeah, and I think that this is also very important as well, because as I said before, Malak, an angel, is a polymorphic symbol of Malak, which is a sailor. So the angels are depicted as angelic sailors. Now, within the Kabbalistic tradition, the angels are referred to as the Ben Sira. The wording Ben Sira means son of a boat. Now, it's a special type of wordplay. It's a type of wordplay which is known as diptych paronomasia. So the word Sira, which is the Hebrew word for a boat, is rendered in the Arabic as Sira, which is Sirius. So the Ben Sira, which are a son of the boat, can also be equivalent to the Ben Sira, which is a son of Sirius. Now, the Ben Sira, they're equated with, so we see that there's an etymological relationship in the Aramaic with Zar, which is an angel or an alien. Now, it's polymorphic, so an angel, Zar, an alien, is also the same as an angel or a stranger or a foreigner. So the angels were represented as strange or unusual, but they were also equated in the traditions with the planting of life on the earth, which is panspermia within the Greek traditions. So you've seen that there's this correspondence, if you like, between Zar, which is an angel or an alien, Sira, which is a boat, but also this correspondence with Zara, which is to sow, Zaria, which is seed. So they planted the seed of the earth, and they planted this, and this is known as panspermia. So when you look at the etymology of Sira, which is the Hebrew word for a boat, the Arabic word Sira, which is Sirius, is related to Yetzira, which is creation, and Yetzer, which is a creature. So we're seeing that there is this correspondence with these angelic beings, which are sailors, which in the Greek tradition, according to Anaxa, let me pronounce his word, his name correctly, Anaxagoras, the princely speaker. But we're seeing that this is equated with panspermia. And so the angels are equated with the planting of the seed on the earth. Now, what's very interesting is that when you go into the Hebrew word, the modern Hebrew word for an alien, we see that the modern Hebrew word for an alien is Kazar. Now, Kazar, K is living, and Zar means an alien, but it's polymorphic, because in the ancient Aramaic, it also meant an angel. So a living alien is synonymous with a space alien. But what's interesting is that Kazar is equated with the Elohim or the Elokei, which is a high creature or a living God. So the terminology is polymorphic within the ancient Aramaic. So when they were referring to a living God, the word Elohim, which are the high ones, K, which is living, but Kr is coming from the root word an animal, and in the Aramaic, K could also refer to an animal. So Elokei is a living God or a high creature. The terminology is polymorphic. And I just want to now go into like what you were referring to about the spiritual tradition, because I think that this is also very important, because when we're dealing with the angels, they are depicted as this paradoxical race. And so therefore we're seeing that there is this relationship between an Elokei, which is a high creature. As we said, this high creature is related to Kezar, which is a space alien in the Aramaic, Zar, which is an angel or an alien. But also they're contrasted with the Ruach Elohim, the high spirits. Now, the high spirits is another word for a jinn. And so we're seeing that the traditions of the jinn are closely correspondent with the angelic tradition, and that the angels are depicted both as physical and also spiritual. And we're also seeing that the angels, Zar, an angel or an alien, is equated with Sira, which is the boat. Again, Malach, an angel, is equated with Malach, a sailor, Mekal, which is a container. This is a type of angelic vessel, which were represented as the opening wheels, or were represented as shields as well, which are equated with ships within symbolism. So that was a very good point which you made about the spiritual hosts, and we can talk about that.
Definitely. Before we get too far into it, I mean, this is a deep, and it can get complex at times. I'd like you to talk a little bit about what you mean by holographic culture in your first book, to help kind of people understand what that is.
Okay, yes, that's a very complicated term. A holographic culture is really discussing a race of beings that have deconstructed the mechanics of reality. So in other words, they exist outside of time, and they are both physical entities, and they are also spiritual entities. I refer to them as a somnumatic species.
Now, would these be the same or different than the angelic beings you were speaking of earlier?
Yes, these are the angelic beings. They are also the jinn. They are one and the same thing. So I want your viewer... I want the viewer to try and realize that these are physical beings, but because they've deconstructed the mechanics of waveform reality, they understand that the waveform, which is the implicated order, can be manifested as a particle, and that gives them mastery over time and space. So in other words, they can dematerialize from this physical realm and they can become invisible. I believe that this is technological. It doesn't have to be technological, but I think that the evidence is pointing to the fact that it is technological, because obviously you have this relationship with angelic vessels or boats or ships, which are represented as wheels within the apocryphal tradition. So they've deconstructed the waveform mechanics. Now, this closely equates with the Pythagorean monochord. According to Pythagoras, the monochord is a vibrating string. Now, the quicker the vibration is the spirit realm, the slower the vibration, and therefore the lower the note, this is the physical reality. And so the vibrating string is the waveform, and the waveform can materialize as a particle, and this is waveform duality. So these beings have deconstructed the mechanics of waveform reality. They understand this. Now, I also believe that because that they've deconstructed waveform reality, they've not only outside of space, but they've deconstructed time as well, because time and space are one and the same. They are, if you like, synonyms. But in addition, they also they've deconstructed the spirit realm, because the evidence is pointing to the fact that the spiritual realm is equated with the waveform, and the waveform is this implicated order. Plato talked about this as the universal form. The universal form is the world of ideas, and ideas are materialized or particularized, as Plato would say, as a particular form. So this is the juxtaposition, if you like, between the implicated order, which is the spiritual realm, the imaginal realm of ideas, and now the imaginal realm or the spiritual realm is then manifested physically or is particularized as a particle. So this is waveform reality. So these beings have deconstructed the mechanics of reality, and therefore they understand the fact that the universe itself is similar to a hologram. I don't want the listener to think that literally it is a hologram, but the word hologram is a useful metaphor for us to actually describe how the universe is, how we have this relationship between the juxtaposition between the spirit, pneuma, the spirit, and nous, which is the mind, which is equated in the traditions with nous, which is a boat, because these craft are controlled via the spirit of the mind. And these beings, they use their minds in order to control these vessels.
Now, when you're talking about the question of extraterrestrial or alien, you believe they're one and the same. There are many researchers that believe there are many different races of these beings, and different from different star systems, and they may have different agendas. What are your thoughts on that? Are there different races visiting us?
Yes, this is a really interesting question. Essentially, within the occult tradition, you have a partition within knowledge, and this partition is angels, which are non-human angels, which imparted knowledge to mankind, which can be understood as the seraphim. And then you have this humanist tradition, which are these human angels, which are the cherubim. So I refer to this within my research as the seraphim-cherubim dialectic. So you have these two types of entities or angels, the cherubim, which are these proto-human angels, and then the seraphim, which are these non-human angels. And this goes back into the Pythagorean-Euclidean dialectic. So we're seeing that these angels are connected to the dialectic. But to give you some etymologies in terms of how the angels are related to sailors, if we look at the seraphim are non-human angels. So Seraph, a serpent, is equated with Sapan, a sailor, and Safina, which is a ship. Now with the cherubim, we see that there's a relationship with cherub and kara, carib, which is a type of small landing craft or a small type of vessel. So in both cases, the seraphim and the cherubim are equated with vessels or craft. Again, we see that there is this relationship with Malak, an angel, Malak, a sailor, Makel, which is a type of container. So again, we're seeing that certainly within the early traditions that the angels were equated with these type of ships or vessels. And this goes back into what we would describe as new ufology, or these circular craft, which are equated with the Ophanim wheels. So, But there are many different, if you like, there are many different types of entities or races which are coming to this planet. But when we look at who controls this planet, then the evidence seems to be that Sirius is equated with the planting of life on the Earth. So they own this planet, and therefore, by connotation, that would suggest that the protocols for visiting this planet, that there would be strict protocols. So obviously other types of races and other types of entities would have to follow those protocols. So, and this is why the dragon keeps on appearing within the occult tradition. And it's very interesting, because I see behind you, there's an all-seeing eye. Now in the ancient Greek, Drakos is used in the ancient Greek to refer to an eye, which is equated to drachein, which is to look or to flash. Now, this is essentially equated to the watchers, because there is this relationship between Sofef, a watcher in the Hebrew, Seraph, which is a serpent, which is the seraphim, which are these non-human angels, Seraph, which is fire. The fire is used to denote Sirius, the shining star Sirius. But again, we see that the dragon is equated with the representation of the gods. So there is this, if you like, this correlation between Theos, a god, Theros, a watcher, Therion, which is a beast, And again, in the ancient Aramaic, we see that there's a relationship between Yahweh and Yara, which is to see. In fact, Yahweh is referred to Yahweh Yira, Yahweh will see. And again, this is a manifestation of the watchers. Erin are the watchers. Now, the Elohim are equated with Erin, which are the watchers or the shining ones. And the Erin were described as having faces like vipers in the Testament of Amram. Amram, who traditionally is described as Moses' father, he had visions of the watchers, and he described the Erin as having faces like vipers, which would equate them with Sopheth, a watcher, and Seraph, which is a serpent, which is equated with Safina, which is a ship. So we're seeing, if you like, that the non-human angels are represented with the all-seeing eye, which is equated with the watchers. And typically with the all-seeing eye, the eye is shining as well. Hence the Erin, which is the watcher, is polymorphic of Erin, which are the shining ones. So there's this correspondence between Ur, which is a watcher, and Or, which is light. And this is why the word Nakash, a serpent in the Hebrew, can also denote a shining one. And this is why the eye is typically represented as shining, to denote the watchers. And within Judaic symbolism, you'll see that the Ophanim wheels, which in today's parlance is a flying saucer, is typically represented as these interlinking wheels. Now, it can also be referred to as a cog as well within the occult tradition. So, for example, the etymology of Shen, which is a cog, is polymorphic of the word tooth. And so the tooth is used often to denote the cog. Within Pythagorean symbolism, you would see the triangle combined with the circle, which is a tooth, of a, and cog, which denotes the Ophanim wheels, which are these interlinking cogs. And so therefore, the flying saucers traditionally were understood to be a series of intersecting cogs, and they link together as a series of intersecting cogs.
Man, that is fascinating. I'd like to know, what are some of the most profound either verses or stories or texts from either the Bible or even previous ancient scriptures or texts that indicate that we were interacting with these beings, and that these were, you know, off planet craft, or, you know, not of this world?
Yeah, well, in the Quran, it refers to that mankind is created from a drop of sperm. And this is very interesting, because that would actually denote that the Adamic human came from this proto seed. So I think that that's very interesting. And again, that's found in Al-Najm, which is the Star Sutra. Now, Allah is referred to as the Lord of Sirius. Now, Muslim scholars will tend to suggest that this is, if you like, was a parody, because basically the Arabs, they had this tradition that Allah was equated with Sirius, but they were saying that Muhammad was basically saying that he was the Lord of the entire universe, not just of Sirius. But when we look at this, we see that certainly the seraphim are equated with Sirius, and this is because the wording seraph, which is a non-human angel, serepha, which is fire, is really a representation of Sirius. So the wording Sira, which is Sirius in the Arabic, is equated with Sara, which is a spark. So Sira means the sparkling one, and Sara, a spark, is used to denote cryptically the seraphim, because of their relationship between Serepha, which is fire, and Seraph, which is a serpent. And this is why within, let's say, Quranic exegesis, the jinn are said to be born of fire. Fire is used to denote cryptically the star system Sirius. And so again, within the Quran, sometimes there's a reference between this idea that the angels are equated with boats and vessels. But this kind of symbolism is also found within the Bible as well, and it's particularly found within the name of Yahweh Sabaoth. So Yahweh Sabaoth is the Lord of the host. The word host here can be translated as an army. So Sabaoth is coming from the root Saba, which is an army, which is related to Sevet, which is a crew of a vessel, Teva, which is an ark. And so these are flying vessels or flying ships or arks. And this is very important to emphasize. So Yahweh Sabaoth is the Lord of a crew, of a vessel, Sevet, which is a crew, Teva, which is an ark. And this is why Malak, an angel, is equated with Malak, a sailor, because these are angelic sailors, which are identified with the Ben Sira, a son of a boat. But remember that the word Sira denotes Sirius, and Sirius is the shining one, which refers to the seraphim, which are born from fire, which are the jinn. So again, these are non-human angels, which fits in very closely within the occult tradition of the alien. And so we see certainly with the grey alien, that the grey alien is represented as a watcher. So you see that there's a wordplay between greys, gaze, and gloss, which is basically equivalent to Theos, a god, Theos, a watcher, Phos, which is light. In the Aramaic and Hebrew, you've got the Elohim, which are equated with Erin, which is a watcher, and Erin is polymorphic of the shining ones. And again, another reference to the seraphim as well, Sofer for watcher, Seraph, the serpent, a non-human angel, Serepha, which is fire. And these are polyglottal symbols. These are found within what I refer to as the artifact, which is this alien code found within human language. So within English, for example, you'd see that there's a relationship between fairy, fire, and fairy. Again, within the Canaanite traditions, Baal, which is Lord, is equated with Baal, a sailor, Bahir, shining. So the shining one, so whether it's an angel, whether it's the seraphim, whether it's the god, I mean, these are all equated with watching, shining, and again, Baal, Mahbar, a ferry or a boat. So again, the sailors are equated with boats and vessels. And this really then goes into what is ostensibly this angelic lineage, which is this naval tradition, which is equated with noblis and noble. Noblis are the highborn. The highborn ones are equated with Nosir, to know. So they are related to this classical tradition. Class is the naval fleet, which is classified, which is essentially this angelic tradition, which is equated essentially with kingship. So Malak an angel, Malak a sailor, Melech a king. In English, we would denote this as kingship. And kingship is really tracing their origins back to the Ben Elohim, the sons of the high ones, or the sons of the gods. And this is why we refer to a king as highness, because we're making a reference to the Elohim, the high ones, and the Ben Elohim, the sons of the gods, who were equated with the Ben Sira, a son of a boat, who were also equated with Malak an angel and Malak a sailor. So I think that this information, it's very novel, because it's not information which has been published. It's a restricted tradition. It took me 15 years to work out this symbolism, and it's based upon polymorphic symbolism. So we're working on word plays which have multiple meanings, and so a word can have multiple meanings. So for example, Malak an angel is a word play on Malak, which is a sailor. And so these are certain types of word plays. And so, yeah, I mean, this is a very, very much a codified discourse.
Whenever I hear the term the Shining Ones, it always seems to coincide that they were very advanced with sea travel and their aquatic vehicles. How advanced do you think that was? And why are they called the Shining Ones?
Okay, that's a really good question. I mean, this really goes back to the Illuminati. Now, the Illuminati is an Italian word, which is really making reference to the Akzari. The word Akzari is a brother of light. It's the Arabic word. Akzari is a brother of light. It's kind of interesting because the ancient word Ak, meaning brother, is polymorphic. In the ancient Semitic, Ak could also mean light. So you're seeing that there's this relationship with Akzari, which is a brother of light, but it's a wordplay on Akzari, which is a brother of an angel or an alien. The two words, as I said, Zar, the stem Zar, means an angel or an alien. So the Akzari, a brother of light, is a wordplay on the Akzari, which is a brother of an angel or an alien. Now, the Akzari, Zaren, an angel or an alien, is equated with Sira, which is a boat in the Hebrew. In the Arabic, Sira is Sirius, which are the shining ones. And the shining ones are these non-human angels, which are equated with the Watchers, hence this relationship with Sophef, a watcher, and Seraph, which is a serpent, which is really another terminology for the jinn. And this is going back to the angelic tradition and this idea that the angels are types of emissaries, but specifically emissaries from these naval vessels. And what's very interesting is that when we deconstruct the word emissary, we see that there's a connection with the word missile. And this is because in the ancient traditions, the emissaries were identified with missiles. Now, we think of a missile as something which is long and rocket-like shape, but within the ancient traditions, the missiles were these circular shields or discs. And so the missile was basically a type of shield, which is equated with an angel. So, yeah.
Yeah, that is very fascinating. I do want to also go back to, you mentioned quite a few times the serpent symbolism. This seems to be a very important symbol throughout history, throughout these ancient texts. For you, what is the significance of this serpent symbolism?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. Well, the serpent is a non-human angel, which is identified with these ships and vessels. So there's this correspondence with Seraph, a serpent, Sapan, which is a sailor. The word put and fur is morphologically very similar. And you'd see that within, let's say, in the Greek between pater and father. So Seraph, Sapan, a sailor, Safina, which is a ship. And so the seraphim are these non-human angels, which are identified with the shining star Sirius. And again, in the ancient secret societies, they're equated with the Akzari, a brother of light, which is a code word for Akzari, a brother of an angel or an alien, which again has this connotation of the Bensira, one who is born of a boat, or one who is born of Sirius. Now, the way of representing one who is born of a boat is through a shield. And this is because there's an etymological relationship in the Greek between pleon, which is a boat, and opalon, which is a shield, which is equated with opalitus, a soldier. Now, within the occult tradition, opalite, a soldier, is concordant with Erpeton, a reptile, and Apue, which is an abductor, because these entities are typically identified with abductors. And so I think this is something that I want to impress upon your audience, that this idea of abduction is not something new, which is equated with the ufological tradition, but this goes back into prehistory. So, for example, within the Roman mysteries, you would have the nympholiptus, which is to be abducted by the nymphs. But the terminology nymph, which is a nymph, denotes a bride, and it has this connotation of extra coitus or sexual intercourse with these entities. And essentially, Nubia, which is to marry, is equated with the Nubagina, which is an offspring of a cloud. And the offspring of a cloud, again, has this connotation of the jinn, because the jinn can dematerialize. And so, and again, it has this idea of that they originate from the heavens. And so we're seeing that there are interesting relationships, if you like, between the abductors, which Apue, an abductor, Ap, which is to seize or to snatch. And again, is equated with Ops, which is an eye. Office, which is a serpent. As we said, the sentinels, the dragon, Drakane, is to watch or to flash, which is equated with the seraphim, Sophef, a seraph, which are the seraphim, these non-human angels. So yeah, we're dealing with a number of different signifiers, which go back to the descendants of a boat and their, if you like, their monarchical lineage, which is ratified by the watchers, which we would refer to as kingship. Kingship is referring to one who is born of a boat, pleon a boat, opalon a shield. And so the family shield is typically, it's placed on the wall and it's placed high up. And that would denote one who is born of a boat. Now, the Roman proconsuls, you can find sculptures of the Roman proconsuls in shields. And so the shield isn't just going back to medieval England, it's actually going back to the Roman Empire and their conception that they were equated with lords. So for example, Archon, which is an angel, is polymorphic of a ruler, which is equated with an Archon or an archangel. But again, the word arc can be a type of vessel, which is an angelic vessel. The word arc goes back to the Greek root olkos, which is a large carrier vessel. So the archons are equated with olkos, a large carrier vessel, and they're equated with this royal lineage, which is archon, which is a royal lineage. But again, in the Arabic also, you see that there's this correspondence with the Sarif, which is a noble, and Seraph, which is a serpent. Again, in the Persian, Mal, a lord, Mar, which is a serpent. In the Greek, Basileus, a king, Basilikos, a serpent. So, you know, and again, the word in Archon, arcane, to rule, in the Arabic, Akim, which is a kin, is going back to the old Babylonian root, Akan, which is a type of seraph, Ak, which is light, which again goes back to the Akzari. So we're seeing all these circles, which are beginning to join up, and the dots are beginning to connect. Now, some people might say, well, just because the noble bloodline trace themselves back to this naval tradition, which is this classical and classified tradition, which is angelic, it doesn't necessarily mean that they are related to angels. Maybe they're delusional. Well, maybe so. But the Illuminati themselves, they take this very seriously. And the Illuminati, when we look at the Illuminati, is really split into three orders. I refer to this as the tripartite Illuminati, which are the three orders of the Illuminati. And I can quickly just go into the three orders of the Illuminati.
Sure.
But essentially, you have what is the human element. So in the Hebrew, Ishman is related to Esh, fire. And then you have the non-human element, which is Seraph, and Serepha, which is fire. And then you have the newly planted, Neophotos, the newly planted, which is Futon, a plant, Phot, which is light. So again, sometimes they will use the symbol of the plant to denote the Illuminati because of this correspondence in the Greek with photosynthesis and plants and light. But again, it has this idea of being planted on the earth, that the Adamic human was planted on the earth. And this goes back into very arcane traditions. So the Adamic man, for example, is equated with Machadim, which is Mars, Adam, which is red, which is the red earth, which goes back to Eden. So Eden was Mars. And then there was this catastrophe, Chadam, which is annihilation. Mars is the god of war. This is equated in the Greek tradition, certainly, with the Titanomachy, the war in heaven, the war of the Titans, and the replanting of humanity on the earth, this Adamic human, which was derived from this proto-human, which is equated with the cherubim angel.
Man, that's fascinating. There's so many directions we could go with this. But you mentioned abductions and how it's not a new phenomenon, how this has been happening throughout time. And earlier you were talking about fairies, and there's a lot of fairy lore that's associated with abductions and missing people, missing time, things like that. Would you consider fairies along the same lines as these beings, or is it something different?
Well, basically, the church, they used symbolism, and they used church symbolism, and they transposed it upon the fairy. So when you begin to look at some of the etymologies with the fairy, you see that there are polyglottal symbols which are identified with the fairies and the angels. So, for example, with the seraphim, you've got seraph, which is this non-human angel, Serepha, which is fire, Safina, which is a ship. In English, this is polyglottal, so the wordplay works in the English. You would have a fairy, you'd have the word fiery, and then you would have the word ferry. The ferry is a type of ferry boat. And so you're seeing in a lot of English words also this idea that fairies are equated with ships and boats, which is going back to this angelic tradition. But again, fairies are equated with fear. And this is interesting because this would equate them with the daemons, daemos is fear, and daemon. But again, with the seraphim, seraph, a serpent, the old Semitic word for fear is wrath. But again, also with the deities, also you've got theos, a god, dios, which is fright. You've got in the Aramaic traditions, Yahweh, which is a wordplay in Yare, which is to be afraid. And as we said, fairy and fear. So these are all polyglottal wordplays which play out in multiple languages. So I would put forward to the viewer that the fairy and the symbolism of the fairy is closely concordant with the priesthood, and that they're using angelic signifiers in order to encode symbolism, which are identified with the fairies or the fiery ones.
Are there any malevolent entities that have been around since the beginning of humanity that could be possibly have steered humanity in their own selfish directions instead of like the opposite of angelic beings, possibly, which you may consider demonic?
Yeah, well, again, this is all going back to the Titanomachy, the war in heaven, and this idea in which is described in the book of Revelations as the dragon being cast down to the earth. And this is also equated with the human angelic lineage, or the fallen lineage, which are identified with the Nephilim. So, for example, in the book of Genesis, the Nephilim is this conjoined lineage with this the sons of the Watchers. So in the book of Enoch describes the sons of the Watchers, the Nephilim, that they're born from the Erin. Now, as I said, in the book of Amran describes the Erin as having a face like a viper. So the Erin are equated with the Elohim, the high ones, but Erin is a wordplay on Elohim. And the Erin have this face of a viper, which would make them essentially, the Erin are the Watchers or the Shining Ones, which would make them a seraphim, self-effer watcher, seraph, which is a serpent. So their offspring, when they procreated with the women of the earth, gave birth to the Nephilim. And so we're seeing that there is this correspondence with Nephil, a giant, and Naphil, meaning fallen, because originally they were equated with Nephilia, which was Orion. So they're astrologically, they're identified with Orion. And again, another terminology for them is the Gibberim, which is translated in the Greek as the heroes. Now, the word Gibberim, again, is identified with Gibbor, which is Orion. Now, the word heroes in the Greek is concordant with Air, which is Air, or the High Ones, which are the Elohim, or the Bene Elohim, the sons of the High Ones. So again, we're seeing that there is this astro-theological symbolism with the High Ones and the Elohim and the Watchers, and there is this war within heaven. But essentially, when we look certainly at the Judaic traditions, and also we're seeing this also within the Greek traditions also of the parliamentary system. So for example, when we look at the fallen angels, the word Satan means an adversary or an opponent, but in the original Semitic it could also mean an adversary of a political party. And so we're seeing that there's a wordplay or relationship between Satan, Sinton, which is two, Shilton, which is government, Sultan, which is the royal lineage, which are identified with Satan, and Tanim, which is a dragon. Again, Tahen, which is to gleam or to scintillate, which would be the Shining Ones or the Watchers, which are identified with Sirius. So, yes, we're seeing that certainly the governments are equated with the descendants of a boat. Hence, within the Roman traditions, gubernatio is to steer a vessel or a boat, which is where we would get the word government. We would represent the government as a ship of state. And again, the legal system is typically represented as a dock, a dock of law, but again, a dock has this connotation of a boat or a vessel. And again, even when we're looking at the church as well, worship, you know, ship. So this veneration of these angelic beings, which are equated with boats and vessels. And so within the church, you would have a nave, which is equated with navis, which is a boat. In the Greek traditions, you would have Naos, which is a temple sanctuary, equated with Nos, which is a boat. And this is because these angelic vessels were buried underneath temples. And this is polymorphic and it's polyglottal. It's found within many different traditions. So, for example, within the Japanese traditions of the Utsu no Fune, a hollow boat or a hollow ship, the word is polymorphic. Utsu no Fune is a hollow boat or a hollow ship, but it also denotes a hollow tree. And so the Shinto shrines have these hollow trees demarcating the parameters of the temple, because the hollow tree is used to denotate a hollow ship, which are equated with these circular round hollow vessels. And when you look at the Edo prints of the Utsun or Funé, they look identical to the flying saucer. So again, it's just really another word for the opening wheels in today's parlance, a flying saucer.
Now, earlier you mentioned that these angelic beings were associated with panspermia on the earth. And, you know, it makes sense to me that, you know, if that's the case, they would be looking after us the whole time, you know, in certain ways. And then they also have the Anunnaki creation mythos, which comes out of the Sumerian tablets. I was wanted to know what your thoughts on if there are any similarities that we can link. Do you think it's basically the same story told in a different way?
Well, yeah, I think the Gilgamesh epics are closely concordant with the stories of Noah. And again, when you look at the stories of Noah's Ark, the Hebrew word is teva, meaning ark, in the old Semitic teba, which is an ark, which is equated with saba, which is an army, and sabaoth, which is the host, the angelic host. Yahweh Sabaoth is the Lord of the host. So Noah's Ark is this vessel which in the archontic traditions are equated with the archons, Olcas, which is a ship. But again, archon and ark, an ark is circular, so these are circular or round vessels. And therefore, when you look at early depictions within illuminated manuscripts, for examples, sometimes you'll see that teva, an ark, which is Noah's Ark, is shown as circular or round. And so this looks like it's exactly the same as the symbolism within Japan of the Utsun or Funé. They look identical, these circular or round boats. And this is because it's the seraphim are equated with Safina, which is a ship. The seraphim are these non-human angels. But again, Safina, a ship, is equated with Sephira, which is a sphere. So these are round boat ships or vessels, or archon and an ark, which is a vessel or a ship, which is ark, which is a curve. So, yeah, we're dealing here with circular ships.
Now, earlier we were also talking about this divine right to rule. Do you think that some of these bloodlines, ancient bloodlines, are still in power today with certain families?
Yeah, they go back into the ancient world. I think it's quite interesting when you were referring to the Anunnaki, because my understanding of this is that, again, I'm very cautious about the Sumerian etymologies, because Sumerian is allegedly not related to any Indo-European language. Now, apparently it's been translated from the Akkadian dictionaries, which is basically Old Arabic. But I'm very dubious about this. But the terminology Anunnaki is really a permutation on what are the Anaki, which is gigantic, Anak, the sons of Anak, which are a giant. But Anaks, but this is a special type of wordplay, it's a diptych paronomasia. So the word Anak, meaning a giant in the Hebrew, is this wordplay in the Greek word Anax, which is a ruler or a prince or one who is identified with heaven. So the sons of Anak is another word for the princely or royal lineage, which are denoted as Anax in the Greek. So again, they're tracing their lineage back to this fallen, corrupted lineage of the Nephilim. And really, the Nephilim are these unsanctioned lineage. And this is very important, because there are certain lineages which are sanctioned, and then there are certain lineages which are unsanctioned. And so there is this, if you like, etymological correspondence between the Sultan and Satan, equated with Shilton and adversary. This is why our political systems are adversarial, because they're satanic. They're working on this political party symbolism. So you would have the high house, the upper house, which are equated with the Elohim, and then the lower house, which is equated with the commons. Commons is the Latin root meaning hairy, which is equated with the mammal. In the Greek tradition, in the occult tradition, this would be the Pythagorean Euclidean dialectic. This dialectic between non-human angels, the seraphim, and human or proto-human angels, which are the cherubim. So in the Pythagorean Euclidean dialectic, you see that there is this etymological correspondence with Puthonagorius, which is the speaker of the serpent, which is Pythagoras, And then you've got Euclid, which is Euclid wrote the treatise on geometry. Now, the word Euclid, Euclides in Greek, meaning good glory, but it is a wordplay on Euclid, which is to copy or to ape. It's the Arabic word. So because mathematics copies or apes the external world. But the word Euclid is coming from the root curd, which is an ape. And so the ape is used to represent this humanist tradition. And so therefore, certainly within the Egyptian mysteries, Thoth is often represented as a baboon. The monkey is used to denote this humanist tradition. Sometimes the humanist tradition is also equated with the ape of Satan, which is this fallen or verboten lineage. But then you're seeing that it is contrasted with the seraphic or the Pythagorean tradition. And this is found within Freemasonry, with the two pillars of Freemasonry, again, which is this seraphic and humanist tradition.
Now, the other day, me and a researcher friend of mine were having a little discussion that I still remain agnostic on because I haven't done enough research, don't know enough information about it. But I'd like your thoughts on Jesus. Was he a real man? Was he a celestial being? What is the real story with Jesus?
Yeah, well, this is very interesting. And again, this goes back to the Seraphim Cherubim dialectic, this dialectic between the humanist tradition and then this non-humanist tradition. So, for example, within the Gospels, Jesus is described as being born of a virgin. Being born of a virgin is really equated in the Old Testament with the Bene Elohim, the sons of the high ones or the sons of the gods. But again, when you look at his lineage, it's traced back through Joseph all the way back to King David. And so this would be the humanist tradition. And so the church was very much split on Jesus and his bloodline. There were two schools of thought. One school of thought argued that is patronage went back to the Bene Adam, the sons of Adam, which is the son of man. But then you have another school of thought, which was saying that he was born of a virgin, which would then trace his lineage back to the Bene Elohim, which are the sons of the high ones or the sons of the gods. So the church on this were split. And then they came up to the conclusion that essentially that he was the son of man, but he was also born of a virgin. So what they did is that they synthesized the two traditions together.
Very interesting.
Which, again, fits in with the Greek traditions of the Pythagorean Euclidean dialectic, this idea that knowledge is partitioned between two schools of thought or two priesthoods. And this is why you're seeing it all the time, that the priesthood is always partitioned, whether it's the Sadducees and the Pharisees, whether it's the Sunni and the Shiite, whether it's the Protestants and the Catholics. And again, this is really going back into the partition of this occult knowledge, which is going back to the traditions of the angels. And this idea that some of these angels were non-human and other angels were human. So occult is coming from the etymology to hide or to conceal. Now, to hide or to conceal is really the traditions of the jinn, because there's this correspondence between jinn and janna, to hide or to conceal. Now, the hidden ones were represented by Juno, which is a shield. So, for example, within the Greek mysteries, you will see the goddess typically holding a shield, and she will have a serpent behind the shield, which is equated with the seraphic host. And so, for example, there's a wordplay in the Arabic and the Aramaic between jinn, which is a spirit, which essentially are the Ruach Elohim. As we said, there's this relationship in the Old Semitic between Awim, a serpent, and Awa, which is a type of jinn, which is related to Awa, which is air, which are the Ruach Elohim. So you've got, essentially, you've got the jinn and Jenna serpent, Junna a shield, and Janna, which is to hide or to conceal, because the jinn are concealed. And this is going back to the occult tradition, which is represented with the all-seeing eye, Drakos an eye, Drakane, which is to watch or to gleam or to flash, which is going back to the seraphim, Sofa for watcher, Serepha, which is fire, which is this tradition going back to Sirius.
Very interesting. Now, for a minute, I want to go back to the abduction phenomenon and kind of take it to modern day abductions. I've interviewed many abductees, contactees, and there's a recurring theme in a lot of these where they will meet their hybrid children, or there's some kind of experiment going on that seems like they're using fertility, like sperm and eggs, and they're harvesting this from humans. What do you think is happening here as it relates to this whole phenomenon?
Well, in the Roman mysteries, they were referred to as the Numagina, which is offspring of a cloud. And the Numagina, again, has these close connotations with the Anguagina, offspring of a serpent, Angui, which is a serpent, Angelos, which is an angel, which are essentially the seraphim, Serepha, which is a serpent. And so this is really going back to these non-human angels. And again, the jinn are typically represented as emancipated. And this is going back to the alien, because the alien looks emancipated. And another way that they would represent the jinn is as a skull or a skeleton. And this is because these beings look emancipated. And again, when you look at the vampiric tradition, the traditions, for example, of Nosferatu, he's bald, he's got a big head, very pale, often very dark eyes. And so this is going back to the traditions of this idea that the jinn are continually hungry and that they continually need to feed, this idea that they're emancipated. And this is really codological symbolism. It's telling you how these beings actually look. And so this is something, again, which is very ancient. It's not something which is new, but it's something which is found within the ancient and classical traditions. And I think that this is really something that academics need to be paying attention to, because I think many academics have completely dismissed ufology, and they've said, well, ancient aliens is a lot of nonsense. Now, I concur with that, because I actually think that a lot of what you're finding within the alternative media about ancient aliens is nonsense. But that doesn't mean that the subject itself is nonsense, because the subject has been hijacked. And it's been hijacked because the priesthood, I refer to them as the disciperati, the deceivers, they don't want people to know about this. This is a restricted tradition. And when you look at the word disciperati, the word disciperati is related to disciple, because the disciple is actively deceived. And so we're dealing here with a tradition in which there is deception. And this goes back into the ancient world.
Yeah, it's such a sad thing that because these elites don't want this information out. And I could see why. I mean, it could change the whole world. It could change everything. We could have, you know, probably free energy. The spirituality would change. Everybody's mindset would change about everything. And it could completely change the course of history, and they would lose all their power, I believe.
Well, we would get rid of dogma. And again, dogma is referring to the dog star, which is Sirius, which is Al-Kalb. Al-Kalb is the dog star. But when we look at the word plays also, we're seeing that the entities themselves are equated with the dog star. So, for example, in the Latin, you see that there's this relationship between lato, which is the old Latin word for Apollo, and latro, which is to bark or to snarl. But again, in English, you've got God, which is a reversal of dog. And again, in the Arabic, Allah, which is God, is a wordplay on awa, which is to bark. And again, in the Quran, he is referred to as the Lord of Sirius. As we said before, Sirius is the shining star, the sparkling one, which is equated with Sopheth, a watcher, Seraph, a serpent, Serepha, which is fire, because the sparkling star is equated with these non-human angels. Zar, which is an angel, an alien, a stranger. Muzar, which is something which is strange, and is equated with Sira, which is a boat. So this is a classical tradition. It's an angelic tradition, and it goes back into the naval tradition as well. And it's something in which we're seeing that for centuries, mankind has worshipped, again, ship. And again, we're seeing that in the Greek, sabasma, which is to worship, again, is equated with sabasmos, which is an emperor, which is equated with sabaoth, which is the host. And this idea of worshipping is going back to the veneration of the angelic host, of the angelic tradition.
Very good.
And again, religion also, religare, which is to mar a vessel. So religion is equated to this idea of being moored to a vessel. And this would feed back into things such as the symbolism of the ship of state. It would go back into the temple precincts, which are equated with navis, a boat, and nave, which is a church, or naus, which is a temple sanctuary, nos, which is the boat. So again, the boat iconography is found throughout symbolism. Symbolism is replete with signifiers of boats. But again, the boat is used to denote this angelic tradition. The angelic sailor.
Now, for the last few minutes that we have for the show, I'd like you to talk about Artifact R, the Roswell artifact. This is very fascinating, and I think my audience would love this.
Yeah, I mean, I was working on the symbolism of Artifact R probably about 10 years ago.
Now, first of all, what is Artifact R, for those that don't know?
Well, basically, it's a pendant, and I came into contact with this through a friend, and I was shown this artifact, and apparently it was a copy of an artifact. So it's not an original artifact from an original alien artifact, but it was a copy. So it was copied in order to be studied. So, and the scientists who were studying it would wear the artifact. So they would wear this copy, and there were numerous copies made in order to study various different properties of this artifact. So, for example, there's sacred geometry. So it goes back into sacred geometry. It goes back into harmonics. It goes back into light as well, in the study of the photon. So it's quite a complicated artifact.
Yeah, that's very interesting. What types of advanced technology do you think that we had? Just as an example, I mean, some of the buildings of these megalithic structures we can't recreate today, the pyramids, Pumapunku, some of these intricate cutting and boring that they didn't think they would have the technology to do then. What types of advanced technologies do you think that we had in those times and lost?
Well, I think that human beings are very ingenious. I think that, for example, when we look at the pyramids, Haram, which is a pyramid in the Arabic, is related to Harama, which is prohibited, which are equated with Harims. So the pyramids were a type of Harims. And again, this is also found with the Pantheon as well. This was equated with the virgins. So the temple structures were equated with virgins, and the human angelic lineage, which were propagated through kingship, which was this angelic lineage. I mean, we can speculate about what type of technologies they have. I mean, I don't speculate about it too much. I just think that human beings have a lot of ingenuity. It's a bit like in 2000 years time, people might say, wow, look, they built the World Trade Center. What type of technologies did they have? Sorry. So, yeah. But, sorry, I'm losing my voice. But essentially they were interacting and interfacing with these non-human entities and these humanoid entities as well, and they come together. So for example, the Lord of the Host, typically the host, when they materialize, they tend to materialize together with the seraphim and the cherubim. They tend to come together. And so within the biblical tradition, as with Milab and the military abductions, there tends to be humanoids combined with this non-human host, which we refer to in the Semitic traditions as the seraphic host.
Wow. Now, final question tonight. I'd like to get your thoughts on what's going on in these modern times, basically since 2017, with the UFO coverage in the media, the talk from the Pentagon releasing exotic materials possibly. Back in the late 40s and 50s, we saw a huge uptick in the UFO phenomenon. It was a UFO craze. The media was talking about it. Government was talking about it. Then we have Project Blue Book. And then everything just seemed to disappear for a while. Wasn't much talk about it. And now all of a sudden we have this new uptick in kind of interest in the UFO phenomenon. Do you think it's just another passing phase that will kind of go away soon? Or do you think there's something to this? Do you think there that we may be being prepared for something or anything like that?
Okay, it's a good question. I think we've had partial disclosure for thousands of years, and it's found within the symbolism. So this is not necessarily something which is new. But what we're seeing now is that there's this move towards what I describe as the synthesis. So really, you have the dialectic between non-human angels and humanoid angels, which are behind the split or the partition within the priesthood. It's also behind the Euclidean Pythagorean split as well, which is essentially the classical tradition and the Masonic tradition, this idea that knowledge is separated between human and non-human angels. And so we've had this partial disclosure for a long time, but we are moving towards now what could be described as the synthesis. And so we're seeing, if you like, there is this removal of, for example, the political party, the left and the right are now being synthesized. We're seeing that there's the removal of the gender as well, the male and the female, the synthesis of gender. And again, even within the Quran, it's... Muhammad talked about that when men became more emasculated and more feminine and women became more masculine, that this would be part of what we would refer to as the apocalypse. Apocalyptin is to disclose, or the unveiling, literally to disclose. And the disclosure is of the angels and of specifically the angelic sailor, and this idea that they originated from Sirius, and that there has been this interaction between humans and these entities, and that these entities, that they are a product of what is ostensibly this holographic culture. They have deconstructed the mechanics of waveform reality. So they can exist outside of time. They can make themselves invisible. They can transport themselves from A to B. And also they understand the spirit realm as well, this realm of ideas where everything originates from, and the realm of, so we go back. So for example, when we die, we go back to the realm of ideas. And this is why within the ancient mysteries, it was important to control the dream, because the dream state is very much closely related to the spiritual realm, the realm of ideas. And therefore, if you can control your dream state, then you can control the physical world. And also it means that when you go back and when you die, then you have control over your incarnation as well. And this was what the ancients believed, that they could control their incarnation and they could control the physical reality through the dream state.
And you mentioned the apocalypse, and right now there is this massive unveiling of truth. There's a lot of people that are questioning narratives, that are looking at things that they've never looked at before. A lot of people that I never thought would look at this stuff. It seems like we are about to enter this new age, and there possibly could be some turmoil to get there. But What do you think that we could possibly have this open communication with these beings again, and just everyone on the planet knows that this is a thing and this exists and we can get back to that?
Well, I think the new age is the new world order, and the two terminologies are synonymous. We've had this private discourse, and obviously the rulers of the world, they have been meeting with these beings. This has been going off behind the scenes. So really what you're asking is, will those who are outside of the circle of knowledge, the circle of knowledge in this respect are the opening wheels, will we be brought into this relationship? I think that's a very good question. I think the fact that the word apocalypse denotes disclosure suggests that there will be some kind of disclosure in the future, and it does seem to be equated with this idea of the dialectic and the resolution of the dialectic, which is the resolution, if you like, between the battle within heaven between the human and the non-human angels, and the discourse which occurred as a result of this battle within heaven, which also relates to the planting of the humanic races on the earth, the Adamic human, the original prototypical races. So yeah, I think that we're living in very interesting times, but there does seem to be elements who want to keep this knowledge a secret. And I mean, it has been kept a secret for thousands of years. As we said before, classis, a naval fleet, relates to class. One who is born of a boat is pertains to class, but this class is classified. The noble line, noblest to know, is equated with naval. The naval tradition is this angelic tradition, which is hidden. So we are still waiting for this disclosure. As we said, there is this partial disclosure, but this partial disclosure is nothing which is new. We've had it for thousands of years. But we've seen that the disclosure has been through symbolism. Now we're having intimations from the government that in actual fact that these beings could exist. So this seems to be the next step.
Yeah, we definitely live in fascinating times. And I have to thank you so much for bringing this information to us. If it wasn't for researchers like yourself, we wouldn't be making the discoveries that we are now and moving so forward as fast as we are. So, Pierre, thank you so much. Before you head out, for those that are interested in finding out more about your books or work, what's the best place to go? Website, social media, anything like that?
Okay. Pierre Sabak Books. You can buy my copy of Holographic Culture and The Murder of Reality. Sometimes I get asked, well, which, you know, I can only afford to buy one book, which book should I buy? My latest book is Holographic Culture. That's nearly 600 pages, so there's an extra 100 pages on The Murder of Reality. But it's also the most comprehensive and updated version of my work at the moment. So I definitely recommend Holographic Culture, which deals with the scaphological tradition, which is this deconstruction of these angelic ships and boats. Anyone who's interested in the mystery schools, and particularly the Serpent Aegina, the offspring of the serpent or the dragon and the djinn, and the mystery religions, The Murder of Reality deals more with the mystery religions and the serpent cults. So again, the books are a little bit different.
All right. Awesome stuff.
P.S. Sabak Books. I've got a YouTube channel as well. It would be great if people subscribe to my channel. I try and put out YouTube every, you know, 1 or 2 weeks. So it would be great to have a few more people visit my YouTube as well. So please check out my YouTube channel.
Very good. I will leave links to all of that in our video and podcast description. Pierre, thank you so much for coming on. And there is tons more we could talk about. So I'd love to have you back on in the future.
Yeah, I would love that as well. Thank you very much for your time. And it's been great. You've been a great interview and you've asked some very pertinent questions. And I can really see that you've done your homework. So thank you very much for, you know, spending the time to research me and for doing your homework. And you've been very sharp and very pertinent. So thank you very much for your time.
Oh, thank you so much. And until next time, everyone, have a great evening.